9 o'clock, but let's just have a quick recap on what we did last week.
Yeah, just quickly go over what we did last week before we move on.
If you remember, what we talked about was this idea of a virtual environment for music. We spoke about that with the sound box the week before, 2 weeks ago, how you can have this virtual environment for music. And what we did last time, I'm only going to briefly go through this, but just to remind you really, remember we started off by saying that you can think of musical texture in two ways, okay? One which you can describe as physical, and that's just when you describe what happens, say with the elements of music, you just describe what happens. And the other one we describe as rhetorical, where what we say is that the sounds that we listen to have actually got some sort of extra musical meaning. So for example, you could hear a particular drum sound, where you're not just describing the drum sound in a physical way, but you're saying that drum sound is typical of mid-1970s prog rock. So it's got a rhetorical description. Does that make sense? So you've got those sort of two ways that you can think about sound. And we'll continue to talk about this as the musicology class goes on. We'll continue, you know, even next year, in 2016, we'll spend some more time talking about this. We'll come back to quite a few of these things. And what we then moved on to is, I've got you to begin to consider what the relationship is between a singer, which is what it would be the majority of the time. It could be a lead instrument, but mainly a singer. And what I described as the musical environment, what that is what goes on around the singer. Yeah, the instrumentation that goes on around the singer. And what we talked about, if you remember, were three types of environment. We talked about an inert environment, where the background music doesn't necessarily relate to what the singer is singing about. It's just there. It's there. So it might be a particular style, but it doesn't necessarily reflect what the singer is actually singing about. I think the more interesting environments are these ones here, where you get into an active environment, where what the musical background does, it sort of backs up what the singer is singing about. And these are, like I've said all along with this stuff, these are also things that you can put into your own music as well. When, you know, when you're writing music, you can think creatively with these things as well. So the active, and what the challenge was, no one came up with any scenario with this, but this is the one that's a bit rarer. It's the oppositional environment, where the singer sings about something, but the background says something else. And I used an example, if you remember, a track by The Police, Next to You, which, if you just look at the lyrics, it's basically a love song, but the backing is a punk rock background. So you've got this opposition. And what we spoke about as we went through this, we talked about how you also get all three of these things when you watch movies as well. You'll find that film music tends to work like this. So you're seeing this link-up, really, between popular song and what happens in the film industry as well. So we talked about those. And then we sort of moved on, where I began to introduce. So we talked about the singer and the environment, okay? That's the relationship between the singer and the background, if you like, the background music. But what about the person who's actually singing the song? And I got you to think about three things. First one is where the person singing the song is the real person. So it's the person who's singing it. And quite often, you know, we believe that to be the case. We sort of listen to music, and we either believe what the person is singing about or we don't. So quite often this all of this links into issues of authenticity. How authentic is the music that we're listening to? So, okay, first of all, it's the real person singing the song. The second thing we talked about was this idea of a performance persona. And what that is, it's where the person singing the song, almost like an actor, puts on a character to sing the song. And it's not them. And quite often you find that there's a distinct difference between this and this. I think, you know, Michael Jackson's the most obvious example. Really, he was a really quiet, timid guy, but not when he... Sorry, this was the quiet, timid guy, but the performance persona was something very different. You find the same in somebody like Prince, very quiet, sort of almost an introvert, but the stage persona, very, very different. And it's interesting to consider the links. This was one of the things I mentioned to you last week, that you can begin to think about researching the links between the real person and the performance persona. How does this relate to this? And the last thing we talked about was the protagonist, which the protagonist in a song doesn't exist in a physical form, but they exist as a character in the song. So, and again, you can look at the relationships between the protagonist in a song, okay, the character in the song, and what are the links between this and this. We'll come on to this today as well, we talk about this. And you quite often find that when you've got people writing music, quite often they may talk about somebody else, they might put it through the lens of a protagonist, a character in a song, but they're writing about themselves. Does that make sense? And it's easy to do that. I found that a lot when I wrote the book on Frank Zappa. He was always doing this, where he was writing about these fictional characters that, okay, everyone thought these bizarre characters that Zappa was writing about, but they had real strong links to what he was like as a real person when you dug down deep. But it was easy for him to adopt these positions and write about these characters in the song. It wouldn't be as easy to come out and say, this is me talking. Yeah, you know? So it's an interesting link that you can begin to explore in any artist that you listen to. And I think the most interesting artists play around with all of these things. And yeah, what we did, we sort of looked at a few pictures. I haven't got time to go through all of those, but basically what they talked about are, you know, there's obviously a distinct difference here between David Jones and David Bowie. The character is one thing, and the real person is another. And the interesting thing about Bowie, you quite often write through the lens of someone like Ziggy Stardust, you would quite often also write about protagonists in a song. So it's what I'm trying to put across to you really are those three areas: the real person, the character in the song, and this idea of a protagonist who doesn't exist in a physical form but is embedded in the song itself. And that's where we ended up last week. We got as far as that. And what I want to do this week, let me say this is the last bit of new information I'm going to be giving you. Okay? What we're going to do, we've got 4 weeks left after this session here. So what we're going to do, we're going to go back over everything. And I'm going to hopefully get you prepared for the exam, which we'll come on to in a second. But also, just give you this opportunity to go back over the last 7 weeks, look at what we've looked at, and hopefully go back to it at a slightly higher level. We've introduced the subject, it's now time to come back to it and think about some of these things a bit more profoundly. And if you haven't already started to dip into reading materials, you need to start doing that now. Hopefully you've already started to do that, but if you haven't, you need to start doing this now, because you will need to reference materials, reading materials, not just me, but, you know, who else has written about this stuff. You need to reference that in the exam. Okay, so moving on from last week's session that I've just gone through. What I want to talk about now is we've talked about stereo space via the sound box. We've talked about how a character can be developed in a song, be it a real person or somebody fictional or somebody who's just embedded in the song. What I want to talk about this week is the distance between the person singing the song and you as a listener. So what's the distance? How close is the person who's actually singing to you? I want to give you a few tools to get you thinking about this. So we've already considered the distance between the singer and the background environment. But what about the distance between the person singing the song and the person listening to the song? That distance, i.e. the distance between the singer and you. Or if you're writing a song, how do you think about the distance between you as an artist and the person who is listening to your music? How intimate or distant do you want that to be? So, okay, it's more things to remember. Try and introduce these in a sort of a gradual way if I can. But this is actually taken from anyone who's done, I'm pretty sure you guys haven't done it, but I know because a couple of years ago, I've been playing around with these ideas for a long time. A couple of years ago, my wife did a counselling course, you know, where you speak to people, counsel, to help them through problems and stuff. And what did she come in one evening and said, oh, I've got this great technique of how I can relate to the person who I'm counselling. Sort of said, well, what's that? And she said, yeah, it starts off as intimate, it goes through personal, it moves into social, and it moves on to public. So these ideas, I've tended to pick them up from musicologists, but they've obviously been around in counselling circles about how you get a distance between you and somebody else for quite a while. So what I want you to think about are these four categories. We'll listen to some examples in a second so you can begin to hear this. So first of all, if we think of an intimate environment where the person singing the song seems to be really close to the person listening to it. Okay? There's an intimate environment. These are just some things to perhaps listen out for. I think a lot of this is intuitive. You just know that it sounds close, or you just know if it sounds distant. I think what becomes difficult with music, like I've said a lot over the last 7 weeks, it's describing that, isn't it? Quite often what we know in music, we sort of know it instinctively, but it's more difficult to put that into words. But this is just to give you a few bits of advice on how you can do that. So intimate, very close to the listener, almost within touching distance. And what you've got the persona. They just appear to be right in front of the musical environment, what we talked about last week. They're sort of part of the musical environment, right in front of it. And quite often, what you will find with the intimate is that there's a high degree of separation between the voice and the background. So you quite often find like close miking techniques, where you can almost hear the breath of the singer. Some singers really exploit that, don't they? Where you can actually hear the singer breathing in and out. It's so close. It's so intimate. And there's other singers where it's very much in this zone. It's not intimate at all. It's meant to be delivered at a distance. I think this one, the intimate, and the public, are easy to spot. We move to the public. There's a big distance between the person singing and the person listening to it. So there appears to... What you quite often find here is that it will quite often be delivered in a very loud voice. You know, sometimes shouting, loud voice, high-pitched you get that. You might find that the vocal is actually positioned towards the back of the sound box so that the singer can actually sing louder. Because you can imagine if you've got a singer right at the front of the mix and they're singing really loud, it might have a bit of a weird effect. So they're positioned at the back so they can sing louder. So, as I say here, loud vocals, and it sounds like they're addressing large groups of people. So I think these two extremes, the intimate and the public, are fairly easy to spot. I think you'll find this when we listen to the examples. It's a bit more different. It's a bit more problematic to the difference between, to differentiate between the personal and the social. To be honest, there's nothing exact for this. I'm not going to be, reading what you've written and go, well, no, okay, I believe it to be social, but they've said it's personal. This is more really just to give you an idea of how you can write about that. And, as I've said all along, there's a certain amount of subjectivity. The point is that you're actually using these tools. It would obviously, I might disagree if you're saying something sounds really intimate and close, if it's obviously in this category. Yeah, I might have something to say about that, but when you've got two that are close together, it's sometimes very difficult to tell them apart. So for the moment, just think of these four zones going from very intimate to very public. Intimate, personal, social, and public. And then what we'll do, let's just listen to a couple of examples and see if I can help you understand what they sound like. And as always, what I want you to do is to apply that to your own music. Listen to your own music with that critical ear to try and understand how this works. So, okay. That's what I want you to listen to when we listen to this example is how does the environment change? Because the way that I've described it here is that it's static. So that, for example, it's intimate all the way through, or it's public all the way through. Music doesn't work like that. The way that you tend to get interest in music is quite often it will go from a very intimate environment to a very public environment. That's ways of getting interest, quite often between verses and choruses. So I want you to listen out for that, and then we'll have a chat about that as we go through. Let's listen to this piece by Joe Cocker, A Little Help From My Friends. It's an old Beatles song.
Doesn't worry you to be alone. all the time. Yeah.
What do you see when you turn out the light?
I can't tell you, but it sure feels like mad.
So, if we just go back a little bit. Okay. How does this work with that song? Yeah.
So the way that I took it is, because obviously I know the original.
You know the original Beatles song? Yeah.
So before I was thinking, like, what it would be, in my mind it would be social, because one, it's a social matter.
That's true.
It's kind of upbeat song. It's not like it's like you can relate to it, but you're not in a point where it's like, yeah, that's how I'm feeling. However, in this version, it's more personal because he's changed at the end of it, the social thing about being friends, and he's made it almost like saying his best friend is his lover.
It is different to the original Beatles one, isn't it? As you say, it sort of changes the emphasis a little bit.
Yeah.
And for me, it's got a lot more highs and lows.
Yeah.
Any other comments on how that song relates to this? Where do you think it moves between, you know, between, say, the verses and the choruses? What are the two sort of, if we call them proximic zones?
Public and social, or maybe social and personal, but probably more public and social.
Yeah, so I would say it certainly sounds like the choruses seem to be fitting into this, don't they? They're very loud. Maybe this, you know, I'm not bothered about it being, but the choruses certainly aren't that. Because, and again, what you do with these things, you know, it's a personal interpretation. You might go, well, how is it that? And obviously, you know, you can't just go, well, the chorus is public or it's social. You've got to ask that $50 million question. Why? How is that? Has anyone got any reasons? I mean,
I think with the first verse, it's definitely quite personal, but I think the addition of backing vocals changes it to more of like a public kind of,
Yeah, good. I was hoping somebody would pick up on that, that the addition of the backing vocals are really key, I think, because it immediately makes it one of these two, isn't it? Either social or public, because it's got the inbuilt effect, I suppose, of somebody agreeing with you. You get by with a little help from your friends. If other people are singing that with you, it's like, okay, I'm not on my own. So first of all, I think, yes, the backing vocals are definitely part of moving it from, you know, be it, if the verses are here somewhere, between these two, the choruses are here because of backing vocals definitely being one of them. What else brings it into that zone, the chorus? So we're not talking about the lyrics necessarily. We're talking about the environment, the sounds.
Big guitar, strumming chords there, like in the chorus that we miss.
Yeah, what else? I mean, you notice the differences. It started off, the verses, you know, bass guitar, a little bit of very tender of Hammond organ, very sparse texture when it started off. So what that did, it enables the singer to sing far more quietly. Because the singer sings more quietly, it has the capacity of sounding more intimate or personal when you're singing quiet. And then what you found in the choruses, in addition to the backing vocals, you've got more instrumentation. The distorted guitar, and generally, the backing vocals, obviously, the instruments are just playing louder, so it automatically moves it into this social and public sphere, I suppose. And when you look at the lyrics, I mean, I wasn't originally going to ask this, but who's singing that song? would you think in terms of, you know, has anyone heard that version before? You heard the Joe Cocker version? It's quite a well-known version, but it isn't the Beatles version, which is the reason I chose it. Joe Cocker was he just died very recently, but he was an iconic sort of vocalist. You can hear that voice has been imitated a lot over the years. But the little, you don't know a great deal about him, but what you do know about him, would you think it's the real person, or would you think it was a character? Which of those two would you say it would fit into from just listening to it?
I think it's probably closer to the real person singing that one, yeah.
Who agrees with that? Somebody else? Yeah. Real person, yeah. Not a character. That, and there's, what you could do, you could back that up by looking at images of him. There was no persona with Joe Cocker, it was just him singing. So there's a sense of authenticity there. In terms of the subject matter of the song, though, that's another matter, isn't it? It isn't necessarily about him. It's the sort of song that I think anybody could latch on to. We'll come on to that in a second. Because you can latch on to those things. You get by with a little help of your friends. It's got a sort of a general meaning. But hopefully you get the idea. And what you've got to bear in mind is it isn't exact. But what this model hopefully does, it just gets you thinking about that relationship between the singer and yourself. How does the arrangement of the song sort of embed this variety of meaning? And you might find that some songs remain intimate all the way through. You might find some songs, I mean, I can think of a lot of rock music, for example, where right from the word go, it's public, and it just stays public. And there's a lot of ballads. They start intimate and they stay intimate. But there's other songs that move between the two. And I think, you know, as a musician, you need to understand how that works. And you need to understand how that works as a songwriter as well. You need to understand it from both perspectives. Who are you speaking to and how do you want to speak to them?
Do you think there's music where you can have like a really loud voice but it can stay intimate the whole way through then?
Yeah, I mean, these are interesting things to look for. Yeah, possibly, yes.
Volume's been like quite a big thing, isn't it? But it's, yeah, the songs where you can have like a really, like a song, you know, which has got like loads of volume, but
yeah,
it just seems intimate.
But it's still intimate. I'm talking about the sort of stereotypical examples of intimacy, where, you know, you can hear the breath in the vocal. There's loads of examples of that, close miking and usually quietly sung. But they're the sort of questions that I want you to start to ask. Is it possible to do that? Can you have a loud voice and can it sound intimate? Look out for those examples. Be inquisitive with stuff like that. What is it that makes music sound intimate? What is it that does that? What is it that makes it sound public? What I would like to think would happen off these 7 lectures that I've given thus far is that it just instigates those sorts of questions in your own sort of musical development. You know, they go beyond what I've taught you, but you begin to ask those sort of questions. Okay, let's listen to one more very quick example. This time we're going to listen to a typical sort of ballad, this one by Whitney Houston. Just listen to the beginning of this, and the same question, really. How does this arrangement, and notice I'm talking about arrangement, going back to lecture 1, song, arrangement, and track. I'm talking about, it's the arrangement that does this, not the song. It's the arrangement that does this. How does this particular arrangement play around with these different levels of intimacy? So let's just listen to one more example and then we'll move on.
I know.
a hint of it somewhere, doesn't it?
That you just don't see, but
you hear her breathing?
You would only take the time. I know in my heart you find.
It's interesting to consider how it moves from those two extremes, just through the use of dynamics mainly, but also the range of the voice. She's singing much higher in the choruses and louder in the choruses as a consequence of that, so it sounds more public. What impact does it have on the meaning of the song? You know, what it actually puts across is that the love she's got for whoever she's singing about is public knowledge. It's not just private. She's sort of declaring it. And that's what the impact of that sort of arrangement does. And what you'll quite often find in arrangements like that one, you could probably analyse 100 ballads, and they would all use very similar technique, classic ballads, going back sort of 40 years of popular songwriting from the 70s through to the present day. You'd find the same sort of techniques, that the public bit of it, i.e. the chorus, quite often will gradually get louder, so it becomes more public as the arrangement goes on. Does that make sense? So the second chorus is actually louder, more greater texture than the first chorus, and it becomes gradually more public. And these are just arrangement. These are just techniques that producers use. They don't use, I've never heard this sort of terminology used in a recording studio. But that's beside the point. Quite often this sort of stuff's very intuitive. But when you're writing about music, you've got to have ways of describing it. And that's what that does. That's what this does. It gives you a vocabulary to describe it. We'll come back to this. In coming weeks, because I'm sort of thinking about how to use the next 4 weeks. I want you guys to do more work. I've done all the talking for the first 7 weeks. So in the next 4 weeks, I think it's time for you guys to think, well, this is how we interpret these techniques. We'll talk about that next week. Right, okay. Let's just take breath there. Let's take a stop there. So what we've spoken about so far is this idea of a singer. Okay, the singer can be various people, the real person, the persona, whatever you want to call it. And there can be a distance between the singer and you, who's listening. You with me with that so far? Yeah, you get that? So there can be a distance, various distances, which can change as the music goes on. The last thing I want to mention today is, how do you interpret that? How do you receive that information? And this is where music becomes really interesting. What I'm going to suggest... I mean, it's interesting, with that last song, quite a lot of you that looked like you were falling into this category. you're listening to the song, and I would describe it as being the passive observer. You're hearing it, but the song doesn't necessarily have any resonance with you. That makes sense? So you just hear it. You're observing the narrative, but you've got no involvement in it. No personal involvement in it. And I listen to lots of music like that. In particular, stuff that's in the top 20 now. Because as I've got older, that music has become less and less relevant to me. So I listen to it usually in this sort of category now, where I listen to stuff that's in the top 40. That probably isn't the case for some of you, but it is for me. Where music becomes interesting, I think, is where you fall into this category. And again, this works in movies. And what happens is, it's almost like you inhabit the character of the song, the lyrics of the song. Like I say there, we as listeners relate directly to the character and the message of the song. So we're listening to the song, and somehow it just speaks to us. And I'd like to think that's happened to everybody in this room. If it hasn't, you're not listening to music properly, and I would question why you're on a music course. Music should mean something to you. And if it does, this is the category, usually. You become the possessed protagonist, where you just relate directly to what the singer was singing about. So, category number one, you just listen to it, passive observer. Category number two, the possessed protagonist. The song speaks to you somehow. And this one, the third one, is where, if you take that last song as an example, you've got Whitney Houston singing to somebody. Okay, she's singing to somebody. We don't know who that somebody is. The possessed protagonist is if you can relate directly to Whitney Houston's position. Okay, you can relate directly to what she's singing about. This one, the antagonist, is when you can relate to who she's singing about. Does that make sense? There are more categories than this, but I think these are the big three. These are the ones that you need to think about. So when you're listening to music, okay, there's the distance between the singer and you. How does that work? There's the distance. Secondly, how is the music impacting you? How is it impacting you? Passive observer, possessed protagonist, where you relate very much to the person singing the song, or the antagonist, which is where you're relating to the person who the person singing the song is singing to, if that makes sense. I haven't said that very well. Do they make sense? Yeah? So, what I want to do is I want to play a personal example of that. I've got to hold my hands up. I come from a background of playing a lot of jazz, instrumental music, and because of that, I don't listen to lyrics much. I've got to confess that. When I listen to music, I tend to analyse the music first, and the lyrics tend to come second. Quite often find that, you know, drummers tend to listen to the drums more, guitar players tend to listen to the guitar more, and quite often the lyrics can be missed. I think when you're analysing popular song, obviously the lyrics are really important. Just, as I've mentioned to you before, just finished writing a book on Sting, and one of the songs that I analysed was this song, Dead Man's Boots. Now what I want to do is just play a little bit of it, and then what we'll do is just talk about how some of the things that we've mentioned today work in this song, in particular those last three categories. Now I can guess that they would bear very little. I'd be interested what category you guys fit into with this. I would hazard a guess and say it could be this, when you listen to this song. But I'd be interested where you fit in with it there. Just listen to the lyrics and see if it's passive observer, possessed protagonist, or antagonist that you fit into. Unfortunately, when I'm playing this, I can't show you the lyrics, but you just have to listen to them when I'm playing it. We're not listening to it all the way through, just first couple of minutes.
You see these work boots in my hands, they'll probably fit you now, my son. Take them, they're a gift from me, why don't you try them on? It would do your old man good to see you walking in these boots one day, and take your place among the men who work upon the slipway. These dead man's boots, though they're old and curled, when a fella needs a job and a place in the world, and it's time for a man to put down boots and walk to the river in his old man's boots. He said, I'm nearly done in asking this to do one final thing for me. You're barely but a sapling, and you think that you're a tree. If you need a seed to prosper, you must first put down some roots. Just one foot, then the other, in these dead man's boots. These dead man's boots, though they're way down the hill, they could walk there themselves, and they probably will. There's a place for you there to sink your roots, or take a walk down the river in these dead man's boots.
Wasn't
it the Republic
here?
I said, why in the hell would I do that? And why would I agree when his hand was all that I'd received? As far as I remember, isn't that as if he spoiled me with his kindness up to them, you see? I'd have planned me on and I'd quit this place when I came of age September. These dead man's boots were all way down the hill, they can walk there themselves and they probably will. I've plenty of choices, I've plenty of boots, and he'd never see me walking in these dead man's boots. Or was it made him think I'd be happy ending up like him? But he'd hardly got two hippies left, or a broken pot to piss in. He wanted the same thing for me, was that his final wish? He said, what the hell are you gonna do? I said, anything but this. These dead man's boots go all the way down the hill.
Okay. Hopefully you could hear in that song, it's not what I'm wanting to talk about, but how it very much went from intimate to public. It was doing all of that. What was it about? Anyone sort of pick up what the metaphor was in the song? Yeah?
Well, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
makes sense. It, interesting, not the interpretation that I get from it, but that doesn't make me say it's wrong. This is the great thing about music, this idea of polysemic. Anyone else want to add to that? What they thought the big metaphor was in the song?
It's like, if you take these boots, then it's like, they know their way around the town because they've been walking there. It's like, he wants him to do exactly as what these boots have been doing their whole life, like. So filling those boots, it's like they know their way down the hill. They'll take you there because they've walked there like 1,000 times already.
Yeah.
So it's like, just, it's like, I want them to carry on as he's done.
Yes. Yeah.
The
yeah, that's getting it. I know the answer to this because I interviewed him about it, so I know what the song's about. But it's interesting to get other people's perspectives. One more interpretation of that. What the big metaphor of the song is. It's why it relates to me. I'll talk about that in a second. I'm very much a possessed protagonist in this song, which is why I'm playing it. What the big metaphor is, it's breaking away from the expectations of your parents. In his case, his parents wanted him to, work in the shipyard. They didn't want him to be a musician. They wanted him, what he's saying in the song is that he wants to break away from that. He didn't want to fill those dead man's boots. That's what the idea is. It's breaking away from the expectations of the parents. And the reason, if I can just move on to this slide here, the reason it resonates with me is, although I'm whatever 10, 12 years younger than Sting, I come from a very similar background. First generation university and all of that stuff. So I listened to that song and immediately I'm in this category here. I'm in the idea of the possessed protagonist. There's another reason why the possessed protagonist would work with me. If anyone can tell where I'm from, via my accent, Newcastle. I'm from Newcastle. Sting's from Newcastle. And again, I resonate with that. That's one of the things. And you might have probably gathered, it's an interesting song, this. Anyone who's heard anything by The Police or by Sting, he doesn't normally sing in that accent. He's singing in a Geordie accent, if you like. He's singing in his real voice, if you like. Not the Americanized version of it. You hear him singing in The Police, it's unrecognizable. He's got this American accent, you know. That's not real. His real accent is this one. That's how he speaks. So it's, to me, it sounds more authentic, but all of it leads to me being the possessed protagonist, both in terms of the lyrics of the song, because I resonate with that breaking away from a particular background, and also because of its locality, the fact that it's based in Newcastle. And I suppose what your challenge is to find songs that do that with you. They've probably already done that, but what songs do that with you? And the big question off the back of that is why? Why do they do that? If you do feel that when you listen to music, ask the question why. It's okay to be the passive observer, but what I would say is if a lot of the music you're listening to, you're falling into this category, you probably need to listen a bit closer to music, because I think at least some of the music that you listen to, you should fit into one of these two categories here, if you're listening to the lyrics anyway. This model here, let's see if we're quick a bit of time. Yeah, we've got a couple of minutes. This model here sort of sums up everything we've spoken about in the last couple of weeks. So it's a useful one to try and sort of embed into your brain when we're listening to music. Across here, you've got in the song, is it the real person who's singing? Is it a persona or a character? Or is it a protagonist in the song? Is it a character, not a physical character, a character in a song? So you've got that. In terms of the listener, are you a passive observer? Are you the possessed protagonist? Or are you the person who's been sung to? In that song that we've just listened to there, are you the father? Are you the dad in the song? Because he's singing to his dad. You wouldn't be. I could be. But that's what I mean by the antagonist. And then, in terms of the social distance, how does the song work? Intimate, personal, social, or public? And then what you can do then, with that model in mind, you can then begin to join these different things together. You know, in that case there, for example, that song Dead Man's Boots, it's about a fictitious character who's actually just a protagonist in a song. He doesn't exist in real life, he's just a protagonist in a song. But you can link that in very clearly by reading interviews to the real person. And it actually bypasses the persona, Sting. We're talking about Gordon Sumner, the real person, not Sting. A lot of the stuff he played in The Police was delivered by this person, who's not the same as this one. You can begin to sort of draw these sort of parallels between these different lines of analysis. And yeah, what you've got to do with this is just start listening to music with this critical head on. Reading about it and start listening to music in that sort of critical way. Like I've said all along, not all the time. That would ruin your appreciation of music. I would never suggest that. But some of the time. And, you know, you need to do that irrespective of if you want to move forward with musicology. It's got nothing to do with musicology. It's to do with understanding music, understanding how music works. You can use all of these things in the songwriting process by manipulating your music to fit in with these sort of categories. All right, just to quickly finish then. The exam, I'll mention more of this next week, but just to give you a heads up. It's on January the 7th, and I've managed to book this room for 2 hours. So it will happen in this session on January the 7th for the first hour, and also we've got the second hour after that. And like I said at the start of the lecture, what we'll do is we'll spend the next 4 weeks preparing for that. We've already started doing that in the seminars with the music theory stuff. But what I want to do, I've mentioned to you before this idea of the spiral curriculum, where you keep coming back to things, but when you come back to them, you come back to them at a higher level. And that's what we're going to do with the stuff that we've discussed over the last 7 weeks. We'll come back to this stuff, and I'm going to get you talking more about it. I realise it's me that's done a lot of the talking. One or two of you volunteer answers, but generally you're quite quiet. It's not a problem, that, but what I want to encourage you to do over the next 4 weeks is to start having a voice about this, to start having an opinion about it. And to do that, you've got to think about it between the lectures. So what I would do over the next week, I'll just stop the recording there.